The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
Good evening, listeners. Welcome to our Tuesday evening Space Show program. I'm your host for tonight, David Livingston. Thank you very much for tuning in. Very interesting program tonight, and more about that in just a second. A couple of very quick announcements. We're planning a 60-minute formatted program tonight, but if you're calling us or emailing us or on a roll, we'll continue going. And I'm already getting a call, and nobody even knows what the show is about yet. Amazing. We'll let the caller tire out, and then I'll disconnect the phone, listeners, until we're ready to start taking calls. The other announcements are tomorrow for Hotel Mars with John Batchelor, we're going to be talking about the idea of a supersonic transport commercial plane. Mr. Batchelor wants to cover that, so Alan Boyle is going to be covering that with us. So that's tomorrow. And on Friday, we have economist, I hope I get his name right, Dr. Akhil, A-K-H-I-L, Rao, R-A-O, on economics and space debris and related topics. And Sunday is open lines on June 13th. And those of you who would like to call, any topic, every topic is fair game. So we'd love to hear from you, and more about that during the week. So for tonight, our toll-free number, and I'll introduce our guest in just a minute, is 866-687-7223. It is turned off for the moment. I would like our guest to put forth what he is going to talk about before you start calling. I mean, that seems reasonable, right? So, again, 1-866-687-7223, and I will let everybody know when the line is turned back on. You can email us at drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com, and you can post a comment or ask a question on our blog, which is thespaceshow.com. Go all the way over to the far right for the upcoming show menu, and today this program is the first show listed, and that is with Dr. Martin Ross. And then scroll down, and you'll see this place at the bottom where you can post a comment or a question. As soon as you do that, I will get a copy of it and can introduce your comment or question to our program today. So we're welcoming Dr. Martin Ross to the program. I believe this is the first time he's been on the show. He is with the Aerospace Corporation out of El Segundo, California, and he conducts research concerning the effects of space systems on the atmosphere. He has a Ph.D. in planetary and space physics from UCLA and a B.S. in aerospace engineering from the University of Michigan. He is the author of over 50 papers on a variety of subjects in science and engineering. He's been an adjunct professor at Emory-Riddle Aeronautical University, teaching meteorology and the history of science. At UCLA, he studied the internal structures of outer planet satellites, turning to atmospheric science after joining aerospace in 1988. Dr. Ross provides technical leadership across a variety of corporate and government-sponsored projects involving the global impact of aerospace propulsion emissions and remote sensing of space vehicles during launch and reentry. And he served as co-author on the 2018 WMO Scientific Assessment of Ozone Depletion and is currently developing innovative interagency strategies, to better understand how the space industry can innovate and grow in a sustainable environment. Dr. Ross, welcome to the Space Show. It's a great honor and pleasure to have you on the air tonight. Are you there?
Thank you, Dave. Yes, thank you, David. I'm happy to be here this evening.
So I found out about you from several other guests we've had that have referred to your work into a paper that I posted on the blog, I think you wrote in 2018, about rocket launches, and also Leonard David, who apparently is a friend of both of us. So it's good to be able to talk to you about rocket launches and air pollution. Is that the right comment, or is that the right way to say it? Or we'll start us out. What are we talking about? How do rockets pollute the atmosphere? I'm familiar with solid rockets and residue in the ground soil. Give us an introduction to the subject.
Well, first, you know, your comment about how rockets affect the environment would have been entirely appropriate 10 or 15 years ago. But I think one of the things we're beginning to appreciate now with the advent of the concept of the proliferated LEO constellations, or large low Earth orbit constellations, is the potential impact of dust particles created as space debris re-enters the atmosphere and vaporizes. So now we're beginning to appreciate that the space industry affects the atmosphere on the way up, but also on the way back.
Wait. Where do dust particles come on the way down? Where are they coming from? How do they get created? Or tell us about that one.
Well, I think we've all seen images recently of objects reentering the atmosphere, and the colloquial phrase is they burn up.
Right.
And the implication there is that they kind of disappear somehow. When you have a log and you burn it up, it disappears. But in fact, all that mass is conserved, and it turns into dust particles after whatever it is reenters the atmosphere, heats up, vaporizes, and it gets turned into dust particles that then can enter the atmosphere and change the radiation flow in the atmosphere and the chemistry of the atmosphere.
So is this dust like I have in my house, or are you talking about something else?
It's actually, these particles are really fine particles. They're submicron particles. Micron, of course, is 10 to the minus sixth of a meter. And so these are really fine particles. They are sort of equivalent to the soot particles, say, produced by a jet or a rocket engine. And because they're so fine, they get caught up. Because they're so small, they get caught up in the circulation of the middle atmosphere, the stratosphere and mesosphere, and they stay in the atmosphere a long time. So because they're so small, their lifetime in the atmosphere is years, rather than hours or days, which would be the case, say, for larger particles that are emitted by solid rocket motors, for example.
Can these particles be measured in the middle atmosphere?
Well, you know, it's interesting that first of all, there's an analog to space junk reentering and vaporizing and turning into what we would call a dust. And the analogy there is meteoritic dust. When meteors enter the atmosphere, they burn up and similarly turn into mineral dust. In the case of spacecraft reentering, they turn into metallic, generally speaking, metallic kind of dust, aluminum oxide and iron particles and whatever else is making up spacecraft.
So when a Falcon 9 re-enters to land. It's reusable and it's coming back. Does it bring dust back with it? Am I understanding that correctly?
Well, so for a say for a recoverable first stage, the premise there is that there isn't enough heating of the spacecraft, the first stage, to cause any vaporization of any of the stage. So it can come in and use its engines to slow down and land without suffering too much heating from the atmosphere. But objects reentering from orbit are traveling at essentially orbital velocity, 7 kilometers a second or so. And so these objects heat up and vaporize. And the vapor, it's a plasma, it's a warm plasma, it mixes into the surrounding atmosphere and basically recondenses back into particles. And this process isn't very well understood. We don't really have a good handle on a number of important parameters in order to study this. How much of a spacecraft, what is the mass fraction that does turn into dust of a reentering spacecraft? We don't know if it's 10%, could be up to 50%. We don't know the composition of reentering hardware. Imagine a spacecraft coming in, reentering. It's basically taking a computer and, again, the analogy is imperfect, but it works. It's basically taking a computer and burning it up and creating dust and smoke from that. And you can imagine how complicated those particles are.
So another example that I'm going to ask you to make sure I'm understanding you. A couple of years ago, I had my mom and two dogs on an orbital burial flight. So it orbited, and I don't know how many orbits it made. It was up for about 2 weeks, I think, or 3 weeks. And then it came down and burned up and sort of becomes one in the atmosphere, a great farewell to your loved ones that you're memorializing with this flight. So that burning up in the atmosphere, and nothing came back down that was, you know, there, you don't get any piece of it back or anything like that. So that burning up of that orbital burial flight created the kind of dust that you're talking about to one degree or another.
Yeah, I don't know exactly what was going on there. By the way, that's a really tremendous move that you did, and that's a really heartfelt thing to do. But yeah, the objects coming in at essentially orbital velocity, they vaporize. This warm plasma vapor mixes with the cold surrounding atmosphere. The metallic objects are oxidized, perhaps, and they recondense back into particles. And these particles drift into the atmosphere and get caught up in the circulation. And we suspect that they accumulate in the stratosphere. We don't know this with certainty because the proper models haven't been run yet. But the concept is reentering objects vaporize, turn into submicron dust, perhaps as much as 50% of it. These dust particles settle into the reentry process occurs at about 85 or 87 kilometers altitude. And the dust so created drifts downwards to the more dense parts of the atmosphere, stratosphere, and gets caught up in the global circulation. And the lifetime of those particles is several years. Again, that's a supposition. And so it accumulates. So the atmosphere, the stratosphere right now probably has the accumulated dust created from the last 3 or 4 years of reentering objects.
So what is the goal here? Is it to mitigate this on returning spacecraft? Is it to try to regulate it? What is the outcome? And by the way, this is a dog-friendly show, so don't worry about your dog barking.
Thank you.
We love dogs on the space show. They should be able to go to space with us, as far as I'm concerned. So,
well, yeah, maybe that'll happen someday. Yeah, they're trouble enough here. I can't imagine floating around in three dimensions. But we do love our dogs. So the goal here, I think, is to understand this process. We want to understand if there are any order of magnitude kinds of surprises that we should be aware of. And I think we can go back. You mentioned earlier the solid rocket motor concern back in the 1990s.
Right.
Remember that, when there were certain models that were suggesting that that solid rocket motors would be a significant hazard to stratospheric ozone. And there was concern then that perhaps solid rocket motors needed to be at least curtailed. And we took measurements and got into plumes in the stratosphere and discovered that the worst-case models were wrong by several orders of magnitude. And so understanding a problem gives you power to advance, actually. And so we want to know what is the order of magnitude of the re-entering space dust, because scenarios of the development of low Earth orbit and the assumption that atmospheric reentry is a suitable end-of-life disposal mechanism is a proper assumption. So we want to check that, make sure there are no surprises.
Yeah.
One kind of surprise might be perhaps there are exotic particles generated during reentry that have a very peculiar, very large chemical reactivity, for example, with ozone. And perhaps the particles so generated during reentry perhaps do represent some sort of hazard to stratospheric ozone that we need to understand going forward.
You have an email from Todd in San Diego, California, and he says, is this a problem that launching companies or satellite companies are aware of? Do they take it seriously? Do they do anything to mitigate the reentry of their hardware? Is there anything that they could do?
Well, there are a lot of questions there. Let me try to unwrap that. First of all, right now, the assumption is that using disposal into the atmosphere can be done basically on an unlimited basis. There are tens of thousands of satellites that are planned to be put into low Earth orbit in these constellations that assume reentry disposal is an okay thing to do. And we want to check and make sure that that assumption is a correct one. Because if you look at scenarios of development of, again, what are generally called the P-LEO constellations, proliferated LEOs, or LLC, large low Earth orbit constellations, with the advent of the P-LEOs, we need to understand what the entire life cycle how that affects the atmosphere from launch, which has been acknowledged for decades now to be something to understand, to reentry. Now we're understanding that reentry is something to understand. Because right now, if you look at the mass flux of particles into the middle atmosphere from launch, that's an order of magnitude larger than the mass flux from reentering space debris. In the future, if we have 10 or 20 of these P-LEO constellations running, then the mass flux of particles from reentry will be comparable, if not larger, than the mass flux from launch. And so we, because in the future, the reentry dust may be the largest impact from the space industry, larger than launch. And I just want to inject here something, too. You mentioned our friend Leonard David.
Right.
At the start of the show. And I have to say that Leonard has been on top of this from the very start of understanding this process. When the advent of P-LEOs came about as a realistic possibility, even 5 years ago, Leonard was pointing this out. He really deserves credit for understanding, conceptualizing what's happening here.
You have a phone call waiting from a listener. And, listener, I have opened the phone lines. I like the guest to be able to explain what he's all about or what she's all about before I start taking phone calls. When the guest has sufficiently done that, I open the lines and welcome callers, and we have our first caller here. So welcome to the show, caller, and who are you and where are you, please? Hello, caller. Caller, are you there? We hear your background noise. Amazing. Goodbye, caller.
Well, not even a dog.
No, but it sounds to me like he doesn't maybe call shows that often, and he's got something going on with his phone. You can't listen to the show online and be on the phone at the same time. They are not in sync. And so you have to kill the computer phone, or you don't know whether you're upside down or not. Good afternoon, caller. Good evening, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you and where are you, please? Caller, we can't hear you. Are you there?
This is Marshall. Oh, I think you got a problem.
No, now we got you. Okay.
Okay.
Were you the one who called just a minute ago?
No, I was.
Okay, because you know how to call the show.
Doing something slightly different, and I got in anyway.
Okay, go on, Marshall. Good to hear from you again.
Yeah. I was just wondering, how many tons of space debris fall to Earth every day, and how much of a impact is it on the environment? In other words, you're talking about destroying ozone and so on. How much ozone is destroyed by meteorites?
Thank you, Marshall. That's a great question, and it puts things in context. So let's put all this in context in terms of what space is currently doing to, say, climate or the ozone layer, and what it might do in the future. So we have models. We have some models, the complex models of the global atmosphere are applied to this problem, not nearly to the scope that, say, it's been done for the aviation industry, and there's a good reason for that, because the impacts of the space industry are a fraction of 1% of aviation impact.
Mm-hmm.
And so the impacts from space are, for all practical purposes, insignificant. But there are two things here, and one is that the space industry is growing rapidly, much more rapidly than say aviation is. There are processes involved that we don't understand that could bring surprises of, say, an order of magnitude, and the scientific community wants to know everything in the portfolio that affects stratospheric ozone, because that's one of the tasks of the scientific community, the atmospheric community, is ozone, is protection of the ozone layer. And so it's to the benefit of stratospheric ozone protection to understand all the processes that affect it, even the ones that would nominally be called insignificant, like the space industry is today, and we don't know what it will be in the future. We're all space cadets here, I think, and we all want launch to be as common as aviation. And if that comes about, we'd certainly like to know what sort of future that holds for climate and stratospheric ozone.
Mm-hmm. I was just thinking that many of the meteorites contain carbon. They're carbon-based, and that would have a totally different impact on the atmosphere than an iron meteorite. And, you know, next question would be, what the heck's the mix? And it's kind of like, whoa, it gets very complex very fast.
Well, that's correct. And the natural incoming material is certainly one of the processes that are included in models of the stratosphere and models of the atmosphere. We want to know what's happening with climate. We want to be able to understand what's happening now and what the future is like. And the natural influx of meteoritic dust is certainly one of the factors that are included, like the occasional volcano that injects mineral dust into the stratosphere, and how that turns into sulfuric acid particles, and how that controls climate and ozone. So, yeah, the background is part of again the portfolio of processes that determine the steady state of the natural state of the atmosphere.
Yeah, it sounds like there's a lot of R&D needs to be done. So keep at it and good luck.
Thank you, Marshall.
Okay, bye.
Thank you.
Thank you. Listeners, if you want to call or are ready to call, it is 866-687-7223. Robert has a quick question for you. Maybe it won't be so quick. I don't know. Denver, Colorado. And he says, what is the impact on all of this of the sun warming and cooling the atmosphere? For example, different solar cycles or solar sunspot cycles make a difference. How does the sun cycles interfere or contribute to or mitigate the dust problem? Many people think that the sunspot activity is the major driver of atmosphere cooling and expanding.
Okay, there's a lot there, and there are two things that come to my mind to answer the question here. First, what we're talking about with this dust produced by reentry, and equivalently the particles, let's call them particles now, the particles introduced into the middle atmosphere, mainly the stratosphere, where the ozone layer is, how those particles control what's happening in the stratosphere. So let's keep in mind that that's kind of where we're talking about with these launch particles and reentry particles. We're talking about stratosphere. We're talking
okay.
20 to 30 kilometers altitude. But getting now to the solar cycle, okay, now we're talking about the atmosphere basically in low Earth orbit. We're talking about 100 kilometers and above, where solar cycle has a very large impact on the temperature and density of the upper atmosphere, the atmosphere in low Earth orbit, and the ionosphere as well. Okay? And that, of course, is critical for understanding, the lifetime of space debris that's in low Earth orbit. But it goes back now to this P-LEO assumption that we can use atmospheric drag and disposal into the atmosphere as just a normal part of the life cycle of these space systems, because we need to understand the density of the atmosphere in low Earth orbit from 100 to 500 kilometers today. And you're right, the solar cycle drives that. But I'll also say here, and this is kind of part of what I'm talking about as well. I'm talking about, we opened the discussion in terms of how the space industry affects climate, say, and ozone. But we also have to look at the other way. We know climate change is happening, and we have to understand how climate change is affecting the space industry. And the low Earth orbit density and drag predictions, again, that are driven largely by solar cycles, that is affected by ongoing climate change. Because as the lower atmosphere warms up, the upper atmosphere cools down, and it's becoming less dense in low Earth orbit. In fact, the long-term trend, once you remove the 11-year solar cycle, the long-term trend is about a 3% per decade decrease in density in low Earth orbit, and that's attributed largely to climate change. And that's the other half of this equation that we need to understand. We need to understand how the space industry impacts the atmosphere, but we also need to understand how changes in the atmosphere, climate change, will affect the space industry in the long run. If we want to know how the space industry is going to run in 2040, looking strategically out to the future, then we need to understand how climate change is going to affect the space industry.
How do you think it will affect the space industry?
Well, you know, this is something that that we're only beginning to look at. You know, the Aerospace Corporation is very strategic, looking forward, and supporting this kind of work, looking out to 2040. This is what the Aerospace Corporation is all about, owning what is happening in decades to come. And 2040 is a good bogey to talk about. And so the change in density of low Earth orbit is one of those changes. Another change that we're only beginning to look at is how climate change at launch sites will affect the ability to launch satellites and launch availability. And a number of effects come to mind here. One is, well, consider that the largest number of launch holds, scrubs, at the Cape is due to lightning around the launch pad. And imagine in the future, 20 years from now, where there is more convective activity around a launch site. There's more lightning around a launch site. And so we might take a hit to launch availability there. And for long-term planning of the pace of launches, that's something we'd need to keep an eye on. Another thing might be changes in what's called the heat index, combination of temperature and humidity. And we know that in certain locations, say around the equator, we know that the heat index is going to substantially increase in coming decades, and that may affect the ability for people to work outside, say preparing vehicles for launch. And so, again, affecting launch availability. And so these are incremental changes, but they could have large impact on our planning processes as we go forward, looking out to decades from now.
Listeners, our line is available. Those of you who were calling before the show started and before the line was open, our line is available. Hopefully you will call 1-866-687-7223, and email remains drspace@thespaceshow.com. Is the research that is being done? Is it mostly through models, or how is the research being done on this?
Well, right now it's there are two kinds of activities going on. One is modeling, and the atmospheric modeling group at NOAA and Boulder is out ahead on applying state-of-the-art climate model to the kinds of problems we're talking about right now. So that modeling process is going on, and just kind of scoping studies is where we're kind of the position we're at with say the reentry dust. We're just looking at order of magnitude to identify where the concerns are, where we need to sharpen the pencil. 20 years ago, the primary activity in this process of understanding how space affects the atmosphere, the primary activity was putting instruments on stratospheric aircraft and flying through plume. And that had great benefit, as I mentioned earlier, on saving solid rocket motors from any regulatory hit. And so actual measurements in situ in the stratosphere was the big thing 20 years ago, and I would like to think we should get back to that process. There are some very basic, fundamental, I guess you would call them parameters involved in hydrocarbon engines that we don't understand well. And one is how much soot is produced in the stratosphere by hydrocarbon-fueled engines. We have some history with kerosene engines. We know methane is coming along as a fuel. And we have very, very little idea. We suspect less soot, but we don't really know. And we really need to get into these plumes and measure what scientists call the emission index of these engines. That is, how much grams of soot per kilogram of propellant burn. And because that's never been measured, we don't know what that is. And right now we're guessing at that parameter to put it into models.
Does methane, do you think, make a difference?
So the idea, I think, is that methane produces much less black carbon, is the technical term, or soot. It produces much less black carbon than kerosene engines. If you look at the processes where kerosene engines produce black carbon particles, at every step one can look at the chemistry involved and estimate that less black carbon will be produced. So yeah, that's the expectation. But we really need to get in there and measure this basic parameter of these hydrocarbon engines.
Jerry is in Seattle, and I believe this Jerry is a he. And Jerry says, is there like concern about these problems coming from other launching nations, which might include India, China, Russia, and elsewhere?
That's a great question. The Europeans, as one might imagine, have an ongoing effort to look at future launch. I believe that's what the referent is, their future launch. And they run models and they publish the results of these models. In fact, in that sense, the ESA has an actual named effort in this area. It may be small, but it's an actual named effort, which is more than any other spacefaring nation is doing. There is some scattered interest here in the United States, but none of it's organized. I would suggest that maybe we might step up to the plate here in the United States and form a named effort and at least begin to organize some of the work that's being done. As you can imagine, countries that don't worry too much about what happens to reentering objects aren't, in terms of a hazard on the ground, aren't worried too much about what they do, what the impact is to the atmosphere. So bottom line, ESA is doing something. It's small, but it's organized. The United States, we're doing some things. It's disorganized. And we could do more. Back in the late 1990s, when the threat to solid rocket motors was palpable, we did have named efforts to do that. One was called ACCENT, Atmospheric Chemistry of Combustion Emissions Near the Tropopause, and that was a combined Air Force, NOAA, NASA, NCAR effort, interagency effort. And I think given the growth in the space industry since those days of ACCENT, it's perhaps a reasonable suggestion to think we might at least get back to that level of effort.
Randy's in Tucson with an email for you, and he says, is there anything different with a human spaceflight mission possibly returning than what you've been talking about, these are rockets and satellites?
Yes, a very big difference. Of course, in humans returning, you have thermal protection systems, and the object doesn't burn up. It doesn't vaporize. There's some charring of the thermal protection system, but it's generally speaking, the object, manned spacecraft coming back, do not burn up. So they don't add to the particle population in the middle atmosphere. There was some concern with the space shuttle because it was so big that the space shuttle, when it returned, because it's heating the atmosphere so much that it generates nitrogen oxide molecules, which are a hazard to ozone. But that was looked at by the group at NOAA and the Chemical Systems Laboratory at NOAA, and that was determined that was a completely insignificant impact.
Carl has another email for you. Carl's in Oklahoma City tonight, and he says, I know that SpaceX is launching many, many Starlinks. I also know that there is opposition to what SpaceX is doing. I'm not sure of all the fronts and the reasons why there is opposition to all of the Starlink launches. I don't know if the opposition extends to OneWeb and other competitors, whatever the competitors may be. What do you have to say about Starlink? What is the role of the FCC in this, in these giant LEO constellations? Any comments?
Boy, that's a tough one. That question has landmines in it.
well,
you know what I you know where I'm coming from there. I think. And this has been reported in Space News that I think what he's referring to is that Viasat has gone to the FCC and suggested that environmental review is either absent or incomplete for Starlink. And I have not seen the documentation other than what's in Space News. So I guess that's the extent of my knowledge on that. I do understand from the Space News reporting that environmental concerns was part of the Viasat filing, but beyond that, I don't know.
Do you know what the environmental concerns were?
I do not know. I haven't seen the document I do not know. I'd be speculating at this point.
Well, on the face of it, with so many satellites in a constellation and others doing similar things, and so LEO is getting crowded. You know, they say it's a lot of space, so maybe it's not getting crowded, but it might be getting crowded. Just in terms of sheer quantity of mass that may be in LEO, do you see this as a particular challenge?
Well, I think the challenge comes from, and this is a challenge for all of environmental analysis, even going to aviation, is that if you take a global industry and break it up into its component parts and break those up into divisions or systems or however you look at it, each system has an insignificant impact. And you can show that. What is the concern is the combined net global impact of all systems. And so one might reasonably conclude that any given P-LEO system will have an insignificant impact. But if there are 10 of them operating globally, maybe that's something we need to consider. And that's a problem. It's a problem to pull together on a global basis. Everybody to look at this as a global issue rather than a system by system or nation by nation way to look at it. Because under that breakdown, maybe everybody is quote small, but if you add it up, a lot of smalls become not small.
I have yet another email question. Barbara's in Houston, Texas, and Barbara says, is there anything a launching company or a satellite company can do in the way they launch rockets, maybe design hardware, maybe even the materials they use, to lessen the risk of this problem?
I think the when we look at this as a first order to a first order, it as far as launching is concerned, any sort of environmental impact quickly breaks down along propellant line. You have kerosene, LOX kerosene, some hypergolics are still being used, solid, LOX hydrogen, and now with and methane apparently coming online. Although I have to say, not a kilogram has been put into orbit yet with a methane-fueled engine. So we have to take that with a bit of reserve still. But the environmental impacts break down along propellant lines, more or less. And within a given propellant, the impact of the different systems are pretty much the same.
Have you ever talked to people like at ULA or SpaceX or any of the other companies? And do they understand that this is a problem, maybe even if they can't do anything about it? Is it in the back of their minds? Are you aware of anything like that?
There have been in the past some. There has been corporate support for studies, and I'm not sure I'm at liberty to say who, so I won't. But there has been corporate support, but it's not across the industry, and it's scattered. It's not like the aviation industry, where there is very strong corporate support and cooperation and understanding how aviation affects climate and ozone. But let's be clear, and this includes that actually kind of brings up your point, your discussion tomorrow about supersonic transport. Again, the aviation industry has been very proactive understanding that process. But again, the net global impact of the space industry right now is two or three orders of magnitude smaller than the global impacts of the aviation industry. And so there's more of an incentive, of course, for aviation in the corporate sense, aviation to be involved in these studies.
Does an SST do a lot more damage than a conventional jet?
It's different, and the changes per kilogram of fuel burned. I'm at the I'm on thin ice here, but I suspect they're larger per kilogram of fuel burned because SSTs would fly directly in the lower stratosphere, whereas most subsonic aviation is not in the stratosphere. So, say the lifetime of a particle emitted by a jet traveling at 40,000 feet is days to weeks, whereas the lifetime of a particle emitted at 80,000 feet by an SST would be measured in years.
Well,
so the accumulation is much greater.
In the research I've been doing for that show, many of the experts think that it's already doomed because of the fuel increase, which could be up to 10 times more than what jets are doing, and the environmental damage and the pollution and the cost of the fuel. And is it going to be worth going that much faster for all of what it's going to cost to make this thing work, and how does that translate into marketing and selling ticket prices, and are people going to be willing to pay that much more? So a lot of the experts are saying, especially with the folding of the company in Denver, that this is not going to happen for those reasons, and you just mentioned a few of them.
Yeah, you know, we tried, you know, we did have Concorde, and it may have not been as efficient as what might be done today, but you know, we did give it a go, and it just the increased cost. You know, there has to be a benefit, and the benefit of flying two or three times as fast maybe just isn't there. I don't know. It's an interesting problem.
The interesting thing is they don't think the sonic boom is a challenge anymore. They think they have eliminated that pretty much even flying over land. It's the economics and the fuel that present the problem. Anyway, I've always hoped that they do have an SST, but maybe that's not going to happen.
Well, your show tomorrow will certainly be interesting about, you know, concerning all that.
How does any of what we're talking about impact investment in commercial space, maybe, you know, satellites? Does it reach the investment market, or the investor market, I should say? Is any of this an investor concern?
The way to answer that is to quickly jump to the aviation analogy and the aircraft industry, especially in Europe, is looking to a future where they no longer burn hydrocarbon, where aircraft are either have electric fans, or they burn hydrogen. So there is, at the corporate level, there is some looking forward in the aviation industry in terms of where those investments need to go. I do want to go back to, there's a question, I believe it was from Houston, maybe Barbara from Houston, that we kind of got into the propellant difference.
Right, uh-huh.
Yeah, and I wanted to make a a few notes there, that, you know, we have these four main propellants, and we might be adding a fifth. The hypergolics are probably going to die away in the future. But one thing we do know, and this goes back to the comment about hydrogen-fueled aviation, is that studies that NOAA did several years ago showed conclusively that water vapor emissions from rockets have no impact. I don't want to say no impact, that's not correct. Very, very small impact on climate and ozone compared to, say, solid rocket motor emissions or even hydrocarbon-fueled emissions. So water vapor and the water vapor component of these other propellants, the water vapor from LOX hydrogen engines is indeed very clean in that sense, in that it has very small, insignificant impact on climate and ozone. So the aviation industry or the space and the launch industry could move over to hydrogen and completely and go impact free.
I want to take a minute, listeners, to shout out to our sponsors, Northrop Grumman, the Space Foundation, Astrox, AIAA, Moonwords, Celestis, National Space Society. Without their great support, we would not be doing space show programs like the one tonight. We're deeply appreciative of it. Remember, they do get banner ads going across our homepage. They rotate, and they can change the banners whenever they want. If you are interested in being a sponsor, please email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And once again, we deeply appreciate and thank Northrop Grumman, the Space Foundation, Astrox, AIAA, Moonwords, Celestis, and the National Space Society for sponsoring us for several years now. And you're definitely appreciated. Going back to this matter, where is the FAA on all of this?
The FAA. Well, the FAA has what is sort of informally called the mothership. It's the main part of FAA that does aviation, and then there is a part of FAA that does licenses commercial launches, and it's an interesting, there is a relationship there in that the main part of the FAA, the aviation part, maintains a database of emissions of aircraft. And I don't think that database, and maybe if someone's listening, they can correct me, but I don't think that database includes launch emissions. Yeah, it may be something they're looking at. I'm not sure. Maybe someone can call in and tell us. But so there's that emissions database that includes aviation. The launch side, I don't think has such a database. But they do. The FAA does license commercial launches, and there is some environmental impacts discussed in those licenses. But again, it comes down to this problem and the way we look at this, that any given launch has a completely insignificant impact on the atmosphere, just like any given flight from New York to London will have an insignificant impact on the atmosphere. But when you add them up, when you add up all the launches, non-commercial launches, non-domestic launches, when you add up the global industry-wide, then you've got an order of magnitude or more lever there that makes looking at individual launches not really the thing to do when it comes to these global impacts. Certainly on around the launch site and local impact around every launch, that's an appropriate thing to do. But cumulative impacts globally is kind of where the action is. And I don't think the FAA licensing process has anything to do with that.
Listeners, we still have time. If you would like to email us at drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com, and also post on our blog, thespaceshow.com, as well as calling us on our toll-free number, 1-866-687-7223. Remember, we are a talk show, and I do this all the time, and we prefer your calls and look forward to your calls. So 1-866-687-7223. One more little bit of business, and we will continue, is to remind everybody that the Space Show is a 501c3 nonprofit. We're able to bring you these programs because listeners just like you listening to this show support us, and that support makes all of this absolutely possible. And if you are a U.S. federal taxpayer, you get a tax deduction for your gift. The same is true if you're a California taxpayer. The easiest way to support the Space Show is with PayPal. So we do have a large PayPal button up at the top of our homepage. For those of you wanting to do old school checks, which is what I like to do, it is One Giant Leap Foundation and mails to Box 95. Tiburon, T-I-B-U-R-O-N, California, 94920. And again, we thank all of you for your support. There simply would be no Space Show without your support, and we look forward to your continuing to support us. So back to the program. Does it make any difference when there is a launch or a reentry as to the season we're in on Earth, which would have something, I guess, to do with maybe upper atmosphere winds or temperatures, or whether, you know, like, where are we in the winter or the fall or summer, or the temperature on Earth, like a really hot day at the Cape or a really cold day at the Cape. Does any of that matter, or all of that is just not part of the discussion?
It's not really part of the discussion because what we're concerned with here is the middle atmosphere. The stratosphere begins around 12 or 14 kilometers altitude on up to the mesosphere, 90 kilometers or so. So the stratosphere and the mesosphere, the circulation there is global, and the lifetime of particles, say, put into the middle atmosphere is measured in years. And so it's a very slowly evolving system. There are seasons there, of course, in terms of winds and temperature, but it's very different than the lower atmosphere that has rain systems and frontal systems and seasons. The stratosphere is a much slower moving conveyor belt.
So those kinds of issues are not a big concern or just not relevant, right?
Yeah, in fact, when we model this process, we take a prediction for the annual emission, say, of black carbon particles or aluminum particles, and we just spread that out evenly and inject a certain amount into the model every month at a particular location. There are some latitude effects. There's no question about that. There's a difference if you have a launch at the equator or if all your launches occurred at the equator versus all your launches occurring at the mid-latitudes or over the poles. That would have very large changes from location to location, but the truth is, we launches are distributed around around the world, and there are a lot of launches near the equator. There are launches in lower mid-latitudes, launches in the upper mid-latitudes, and that pretty much smears things out in terms of what the response of the middle atmosphere is.
Joe in Dallas says, with the advent of the really big rockets like Starship, SLS, and whatever Bezos is planning to do, does that make a difference?
Well, in the sense that the impact is fundamentally proportional to the amount of propellant burned in the stratosphere and the amount of propellant burned above the tropopause, yes, it does matter. So if we have a lot of large rockets launched often, that will increase the amount of propellant burned in the middle atmosphere, and the effects will increase in proportion. For these small effects, the stratosphere is apparently kind of linear. That is, if you double the emission, you pretty much double the amplitude of the response. That is one of the things to come out of the model.
Carly is in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and she said, it would seem to me the more dispersed your launches are around the world, probably the better off everyone is going to be. So rather than having a few main launch sites, would it be better to have many, many different launch sites to spread the joy around, so to speak?
So it goes back to this latitude effect. And by the way, we don't really know. Models have been run with the emissions basically mid-latitudes, and we haven't had the sophistication yet to put all the launches at the equator, say, and put them all 45 degrees north, or put them all at the pole and compare them. So we don't have a Green's function, if you will, for the mathematicians out there, for emission. But it doesn't, again, the smearing effect, the averaging effect of the stratosphere, sort of takes that out of the equation, whether or not you have half your launches at mid-latitudes, half at the equator, or whether you spread that out sort of peanut butter style. It doesn't really matter. The stratosphere will blur a thing.
Pretty amazing. Most of us don't hear about anything like this, so I guess this is not a widely discussed conference topic, or is it just we're not paying attention to the conferences or the papers that are published on it?
We are making progress, and there are pockets of interest here. Ultimately, scientific research is no different than anything else, and you have to follow the money. You have to follow the budget. And in comparison, again, to say 20 years ago when SRS solid motors were under threat, there was a lot of money being invested in scientific research to get to the bottom of that, and we did. But now, even though the space industry is larger and we're launching more often than 20 years ago, that level of research is not there. I think there's some sense maybe in the scientific community that we solved that problem 20 years ago, and so there are no other issues concerning rockets. I think there's some of that out there. It's a misunderstanding, perhaps, on translating rocket technology into the scientific community. I think that's one of the things that I would like to do, and certainly one of the things that I try to do by going to AIAA conferences, say, and American Geophysical Union conferences, is try to bridge those two communities. I think that's really important. And it's important that the scientific community, the climate community, sees what rockets are doing, understands that technology, understands those emissions. And it's important for the space industry to understand what the scientific community is interested in.
Listeners, there's still time on our program if you would like to call, and if you were one of the early callers trying to reach us before we turned our phones on, we'd still like to hear from you. 1-866-687-7223. Email remains drspace, drspace, at thespaceshow.com. Where is the state-of-the-art research going on right now, and what is, if you were doing a report on the research, what would be considered state-of-the-art on this topic?
The well, certainly the Aerospace Corporation, if I may say so, is a leader, a national leader in this work. The NOAA community, the climate modeling community at NOAA in Boulder, is at the forefront of the scientific community's relationship with this problem. But there are other groups. There is a group at MIT that is developing a model, and this is really interesting work. They're developing a model of this aspect of the problem where different propellants have different impacts, and going back and understanding how to minimize environmental impact while maximizing the performance of your fleet. That is, what mix of, under different assumptions, what mix of kerosene, hydrogen, solid motors, methane, what fleet mix gives you the smallest environmental impact for a given bang, a given amount of payload delivered to orbit? And I think that's really leading edge work right now.
Is it easy to do that work, or are people really grasping to figure out how to do it?
Well, it's tough. In a way, it's kind of a standard minimization, maximization kind of problem with artificial intelligence applied to it. But on the other hand, you have to understand, you have to specify these relationships between cost of one kind of rocket engine compared to another, the cost of the launch vehicle, the environmental impact of a given propellant, what is the specific impulse of that kind of engine, what kind of performance can you get. And so we're talking factors of two and three here in terms of, say, profit versus for a minimally environmental impact system versus, say, just a system that's been assembled randomly. So it can make a difference. Another aspect that might be included would be looking at, say, a carbon tax. How would a carbon tax affect the launch industry? There is no such thing right now, be clear about that, and no one has proposed such a thing other than in general terms of when you burn a hydrocarbon, that you have to pay a tax. And I think we're all familiar with that concept. But how would that affect the cost equation, the performance, the comparative cost performance equation of different launch vehicles?
What is decarbonization?
That is So I kind of mentioned that earlier. It's kind of this very long-term idea of removing hydrocarbons from our economic system, removing them entirely. And under those kinds of scenarios, it's kind of like the Montreal Protocol that banned CFCs that harmed the ozone layer back in the 1987. By the way, Montreal Protocol is one of the most successful international treaties ever devised. It's a really successful treaty. But one of the things that made it so successful was they didn't pay attention to how much of a thing was used, how much of a given compound was used. If it had a metric that exceeded the specified level, then it was banned. It didn't matter if you used a gallon of it or if you used a million gallons of it. It was banned if it met that metric. So that may be a model going forward in terms of potential climate treaties or regulations, where it won't matter how big the impact of your industry is. You're going to have to play ball. So that's how the chemical industry had to deal with the Montreal Protocol. It didn't matter if some obscure CFC, they only used a little bit of it. If it met that metric, it had to be banned. So in a similar way, in the future, where hydrocarbons are banned, it may not matter if you use 1 gallon of kerosene or a million gallons of kerosene. It just won't be available. So in that kind of eventuality, launch could go to LOX hydrogen in that kind of a future. Of course, that entails a large change in the launch architecture and infrastructure.
And economics.
Economics, exactly.
I have another question from a listener. Carol is in St. Louis, Missouri. And she says, is anyone either historically or just for fun looked at a past rocket like Saturn V and figured out what its contribution would be in today's world to the problems you're discussing tonight?
Oh, that's a great question. I love that. That's great. Oh, yeah, let's think about the classics, right? Saturn V.
Uh-huh.
Right? Okay, so this is great. I could have scripted this, but I didn't, I swear. So this is a great opening to an impact on the environment that launches have that we haven't talked about yet. And that is the fact that launches, of course, they go through the ionosphere, 100 to 300 kilometers or so altitude. Launches produce large holes in the ionosphere. And I go back, so here's where the Saturn V comes in, because this is how this process was discovered. I believe it was the Skylab launch, if I'm not mistaken. And was it 74 or 5? So I believe it was the Skylab launch where we first discovered that Saturn V produced this enormous hole in the ozone layer. And we know that rockets today do the same thing, at a much smaller scale, of course. But again, if we go to larger launch vehicles, we're going to have these holes punched in the ozone layer, the ionosphere. The electron content goes down, and these holes persist for, I don't want to say days, but I want to say a day. And they drift in the upper atmosphere and eventually are healed. But if we have large launches every day, if we launch the Saturn V every day, we would have large holes. Not only would we be putting a lot into orbit, but we would have large holes in the ionosphere moving around. And exactly what effect that has on anything is if there are effects on anything, isn't well understood.
That's interesting. So is there a rocket design that would not allow the hole to be punched? Like there's a design on an SST now where you're not going to have a sonic boom. So could you design the rocket to not punch a hole in the ionosphere?
Good question. I believe that the holes in the ionosphere are caused by the water vapor emissions from launch vehicles. And every launch vehicle emits water. Hydrogen, of course, LOX hydrogen is 100%, nearly 100% water, some hydrogen in there, but nearly 100% water, where something like a hydrocarbon is approximately half of the emission is water. So the short answer to the question is no. I think is when you, if you're burning something, you generate water, and that's what, and that ultimately is what quenches the electrons in the ionosphere. And again, these holes may be just a curious artifact having no impact on anything. I think that that's probably true on an individual basis, although I haven't seen it proven to me. But if there's a collective impact here, that would be interesting to know. If there are daily Saturn V-sized holes in the ionosphere, does that add up to a net decrease in the overall annual average of electron content? And does that matter to anybody? So it's a problem that it's a process. I don't want to say a problem. It's a process that we know occurs because we saw it on a large scale with the Saturn V, and we see it today on a smaller scale. And we don't know what the cumulative effect may be. And we don't know if that's of any concern to any space system.
We're coming up actually on a 90-minute program. Have we forgotten to talk about something, omitted something? Is there something additional that you think we ought to discuss or know about?
I think the main message, again, is that right now the launch industry has a very small impact on climate and the ozone layer. And and for us space cadets who envision a future of where launch emissions might be 10 or 100 times greater than they are now, some of us think it would be a good idea to understand what that would do ahead of time, just like the SST. You know, it's interesting that there have been dozens and dozens of studies of how SSTs affect stratospheric ozone and climate, where there are no SSTs flying, and there will probably not be any SSTs flying, and there has not been for decades, and yet there's all these studies that are being done on theoretical aircraft, whereas space systems are doing their thing now. They're real. They happen. And far less attention is being paid to this real thing rather than this theoretical thing that may or may not happen.
Well, you have military supersonic flights that fly.
That's true. That's true. Although I think that's a very small, it would be a very, very small addition. I guess I don't know the numbers on that.
I don't either, but they don't fly SST during, usually they're not flying their entire flight at those speeds. So support.
Yeah, that's true.
Or something, but it, you know, there's a lot of countries that have that military capability. So Again, yeah. If you look at the collective versus, say, just what the Navy does, for example, the collective might be giant compared to just what the Navy might do.
That's right, and it's all about, for the Earth, it's all about the collective. It's all about the net global emission. And for the Earth, that's what it cares about. The one final thing I'd mention, and something that's coming up, I think maybe some of your listeners might be familiar with it, is this concept of geoengineering. And that is purposefully putting particles in the stratosphere to brighten the Earth a little bit and thereby reflecting a little bit of sunlight back into space, thereby cooling the surface and mitigating some of the effects of greenhouse gas accumulation. And humanity may have a big decision to make on this geoengineering. Some initial studies, there has been a lot of modeling on this, and some initial experiments in the stratosphere were going to be done. And they were canceled at the last minute because of, partly, in any case, because of ethical concerns. Should we even be going down this road of messing with the stratosphere on purpose by putting particles there? And I think that's something that I think there's going to be a lot more discussion about this, and space systems are going to be part of that discussion, whether it's part of the deployment of these particles or whether it's measurement of the stratosphere to understand how these particles behave. And then, of course, there's the connection with geoengineering for launch. But launch already puts many tons of particles into the stratosphere. It's interesting that that launch puts tons of particles into the stratosphere, and yet there's all this ethical concerns about a few kilograms of particles for a geoengineering experiment. And so we're kind of already doing that experiment. And so there's that connection, I think it goes back to what I was suggesting, that there needs to be more communication between the atmospheric science community and the space community, in both ways. I think that would be beneficial to everybody.
Do you have a preference? Do you think we should be doing those experiments?
That's beyond my pay grade.
I would imagine the launches aren't putting the same stuff in the stratosphere that the scientists want to put up there for reflecting heat. So, they may be putting a lot of stuff in the stratosphere, but it's probably not the right stuff for that experiment. Am I right on that?
Yeah, that's basically right. Although alumina particles do behave a little bit like the particles that are proposed for massive geoengineering deployment. But again, those models haven't been done, so we don't really know. But some of the things that are needed by the geoengineering community on diffusion rates of plumes, settling rates of particles, the actual behavior of particles versus in the stratosphere versus the laboratory analogs, all those things could be checked by measuring plumes. We can measure how plumes diffuse, and that would give us a diffusion constant, and that's what the geoengineering folks need in terms of putting in their model. So I think there's something that the geoengineering community could learn from studying rocket plumes, and it may be something that would be good cross-fertilization discussion.
Anything here for space cadets and space advocates to focus on, to think about, to become an advocate for or an advocate against, or is it all above our pay grade?
I think we all want to see Saturn V launched every day. We want to see people in orbit. We want to see people on the moon and even Mars. I think we want to see humanity expanding, diffusing off of the Earth. But there are limits on what we can do in terms of chemically based launch. I'm not saying we're anywhere near those limits right now, but it is true that at some point you can't put 1 million tons into orbit with solid rocket motors without causing problems to the ozone layer. So there are limits. And in terms of space cadets, we'd like to know how crazy can we grow and still be sustainable. Because we'd like to see as crazy as possible. And so we want to know what the sustainability is for a space cadet kind of growth.
And we're not there yet. In terms
we don't
of
have that.
Knowing those answers.
That's right. We don't have that information yet. There are a lot of questions that have come up just in this discussion about the comparative impact of the different propellants. What propellants do we need to go toward? What should we stay away from? What are the limits? Where would the policymakers start to get concerned in terms of ozone loss from launch? Is that 100 times what we do now? Is it 1,000 times? We don't know the answer. We'd like to know that because we want to be able to grow and innovate as much as we want to. But we need to know where the guardrails are, basically.
Marty, you've taught us all a lot today that I know for myself I was not that aware of, other than just hearing about Leonard David maybe mentioning it or someone else maybe mentioning it. So you've been a great professor tonight, at least from my perspective, and I hope from the listeners and those that will hear us on the archives. And I appreciate that, and that's the purpose of the space show. So I hope you'll let us know as this field develops, and we can do some updates and see what's changing or where there might be roadblocks or things coming up that might want to stop us from being crazy. So
very good.
I hope you'll keep me posted, and if you have another paper coming out or something like that, make sure I'm aware of it, and we can feature it and talk to you about it on the program.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Been my pleasure.
My pleasure, too. Thank you, Marty, and I'll get this program archived in the morning, our time here on the coast, and send you the links to it and everything.
Terrific. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you. And listeners, that's it for tonight, and we appreciate your being with us. From Marty, David, and the Space Show, and Pepper, who was up here with me about half the show tonight, from her as well. Everybody have a great rest of the evening. The next program is pre-recorded Hotel Mars, 1 o'clock California time tomorrow, with Alan Boyle on the SST. And then we have our Friday program, and then Open Lines on Sunday. All of this is on our website newsletter. It's on the upcoming show newsletter on the website. We do welcome your phone calls, and our toll-free number is always 866-687-7223. And we don't usually open it until 5 or 10 minutes into the program so that, as I've been saying, the guest can tell us what the guest is going to talk about. And then, you know, hopefully we'll have more and more calls. So everybody, again, Marty, David, Pepper, and the Space Show tell you good night, stay well, stay safe, and above all, keep looking up. Goodbye from the Space Show.